Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Robert and Joseph Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Joanne Freeman.
I'm Nathan Connolly.
I'm Ed Ayers.
If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, and each week, along with our colleague Brian Ballow, we explore a different aspect of American history.
I celebrate myself and what I assume you shall assume.
Well, that's a bold statement, Darren.
Kind of audacious, huh? Well, I'm doing that because today marks what would be the great American poet Walt Whitman's 200th birthday. So on this week's show, we're going to explore how the author of Leaves of Grass and Song of Myself tried to forge a unified American identity at a time of national crisis and division. So we're going to talk about how Whitman tries to thread differences across sexual identity, race, religion, place, and politics. So let's say, just to paraphrase the poet himself, this week's show is going to be large and might just contain multitudes.
We'll discuss how Brooklyn shaped Walt Whitman and what exactly he was doing wandering around the waterfront at all hours of the night.
Harold Bloom tells us why Whitman's greatest achievement wasn't his poetry.
And we'll uncover the link between Walt Whitman and Barack Obama.
New York has always been the literary capital of America, but in the 1840s, Walt Whitman made the then city of Brooklyn his stamping ground, and pretty much the place where he developed his writing and his identity. Historians at the Brooklyn Historical Society and co-hosts of the podcast Flatbush and Maine, Zahir Ali and Julie Golia, tell me how Whitman was formed by his experiences growing up in Brooklyn. I started by asking Zahir what Whitman was doing before he published his epic poem Leaves of Grass.
He founded a newspaper called The Long Islander, and that lasted for less than a year. And then he had a few more jobs, and then in 1841 had his first writing job as a journalist that he could actually make a living off of, and that was writing for the New World newspaper. So during this period, he's kind of, you know, moving around, he's trying to find himself, but by the early 1840s, he really has settled into the idea that he could make a living as a writer, as a journalist, and that would lead, of course, to him becoming the editor of the Brooklyn Eagle in 1846. He'd often take breaks during the day and walk down to Fulton Ferry Landing, and his kind of daily routine. He would write in the morning, take a break, walk down to Fulton Ferry Landing, come back, review the drafts. At the end of the workday, he'd go down to Gray's swimming bath, again, also on the waterfront. So this was his work was very integrated into his actually kind of physical moving throughout the city.
In 1848, Whitman lost his job at the Brooklyn Eagle, but it's not exactly clear what happened.
There are some people who argue that Whitman was just too radical, too egalitarian, too anti-slavery in a period in which people were really starting to choose sides. But there are other people actually who argue that his problem wasn't that he was too radical, it was that he wasn't political enough. And in the Eagle during his tenure there, you really do see him kind of trying to split the baby down the middle a little bit. I mean, this was part of the idea of putting in more cultural content. He wanted to tamp down the sectional politics and actually make this something that was palatable for all, and it actually ended up being kind of divisive for all.
Yeah, and I think even the coverage of the hard news that he did, covering a lot of like the experience of workers and labor strikes, this is also a period of increasing nativism. And so his focusing on the plight of immigrants and workers also put him at odds with the growing anti-immigrant sentiment at the time.
And yet he wouldn't come down hard on the side of laborers either.
That's right.
There's this sort of famous labor strike in 1846 at the Atlantic Docks, which is a newly opened warehousing facility that essentially pitted Irish workers against newly arrived German workers. And Whitman writes about the strike with real sympathy for the workers, but at the end of the article comes down very clearly and says that labor unions are a problem. They are bad for the economy, and he wholly sort of denounces them. And so even that is a perfect example of how he's kind of trying to please both and ends up pleasing no one.
If in his political views, as expressed in the Brooklyn Eagle, Whitman was pretty much trying to nod to both sides of the political divide, so the man identified today as a great gay pioneer was deliberately ambiguous about his sexuality.
I think Whitman himself, he was interviewed near the time of his death and refused to admit the sexual connotations and certainly the homosexual connotations of his poetry, especially Calamus, which was probably the more explicit. But this is not unusual, right? If you follow the work of people like George Chauncey, who talks about the 19th century experiences of men who had sexual relations with other men, you know, there isn't necessarily a label that they identify with. Many of them had a kind of fluidity to their sexuality that didn't lock them into a particular identity the way that I think maybe it would in our contemporary way of talking about it. That doesn't mean that it's clear that Whitman's work was written and it was published at a time and it was being read. And so there were people who were reading or consuming this material and for whom there was resonance. And so I think the challenge for us as historians is how do we surface that without forcing people into categories that maybe weren't as solidified then as they are or have been now.
Right. And in a sense, I mean, in Whitman's case, you might say that it's the lack of category that really gives it meaning, right? That it's that fluidity that kind of defines him.
I think he'd love that. Because he loved the water, and he wrote about the East River and ferries and that kind of liminal space of the East River between these two cities with passion and eroticism.
He definitely had a thing for transportation. He definitely had a thing
fetish,
for movement. Yeah, almost a fetish. He definitely liked moving from one space to the next. And so that could almost be a perfect kind of embodiment of how he thought about his movement in terms of his sexuality.
It was not an easy life, right? And it was not a simple life. And there was threat of danger. There was a threat of rejection. But nonetheless, he interwove this experience into the fabric of all aspects of his life.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that frustration and repression being expressed in his poetry. And certainly the relationship he had with Fred Vaughn bears this out. Mm-hmm. And I think Whitman has kind of ghosted Fred because he's like, I'm not hearing from you. But it's this relationship with Fred that many people credit with the material that comes out in Calamus. And then eventually Fred gets married and invites Whitman to his wedding. It's just like, I haven't invited anyone, but I want you there. And Whitman doesn't go. I think in a subsequent relationship, Whitman writes a note to himself, like, remember Fred Vaughn. Like, this inability to be public about your relationships, but also this inability to be public about your heartbreak, right?
Hmm. By night, he strolled along the waterfront looking for sexual partners.
Whitman, as we've talked about, loved the built environment, the landscape of Brooklyn. And he spent a lot of time on his feet, as Zahir described, both day and night. Basically, walking around was part of his work process, but he also spent a lot of time in the evenings walking along the waterfront. And we know this in part because he kept journals that were read a lot like commonplace books, describing where he was, where he walked, from the street, the blocks that he went on, the parts of the waterfront he went to, and also who he met along the way. And so he described many of the men that he interacted with, sometimes in very sort of chaste or cursory terms, and sometimes in terms that were more descriptive and that at least reading briefly between the lines indicate some kind of romantic or sexual tryst.
In his journals, he would record things like, Gus White, 25, at ferry with skeleton boat, 5'9", round, well-built. David Wilson, night of October 11th, 62, walking up from Middaw, slept with me, works in a blacksmith shop in Navy Yard.
In some ways, if you come to Brooklyn and you walk around in Brooklyn Heights and then down to the waterfront, you'll be struck at first by a real geographical barrier. Brooklyn Heights is built on a bluff. And the waterfront, the kind of working class, bawdier area of the waterfront, is really separate from that. It's down by the water, right? And so you have this kind of symbolic but really truly experienced boundary between the genteel suburban neighborhood of the Heights and the waterfront, the working waterfront, which would have been teeming night and day, but also would have provided spaces, darkness, you know, lots of tunnels and bridges and parts of the growing waterfront that would have given people cover to experiment.
Is there a legacy, a broader legacy for his writing and looking at Brooklyn as a queer space in some way? I mean, what is that legacy?
If you look at the long span of cultural or literary history in Brooklyn, I think there would be little argument to the fact that Whitman is really a forefather of the artistic queer experience here in Brooklyn, and particularly in his kind of relationship to the waterfront, his relationship to the built environment. I can think of so many people who draw on that precedent. Hart Crane in the early 20th century, living not far from where Whitman himself walked day after day, night after night with his lover, and writing about the Brooklyn Bridge with the kind of passion that Walt Whitman himself wrote about the ferry and the East River. I think about Carson McCullers and some of the other people who lived in a house called February House in the 1940s, many of which were queer, who drew on Whitman's sort of veiled homosocial style to tell a story that is all about the queer experience, even as a straight person might read it and not even see that queer experience in the book. So he set such precedents for people to take an inspiration, a really complex inspiration from the landscape of Brooklyn to create their own art.
Zahir Ali and Julie Golia are historians at the Brooklyn Historical Society and co-hosts of the podcast Flatbush and Maine. If you want to hear more about Whitman's life in Brooklyn, check out their upcoming episode.
Crossing Brooklyn Ferry by Walt Whitman. What is it then between us? What is the count of our scores or hundreds of years between us? Whatever it is, it avails not, distance avails not, and the place avails not. I too lived, Brooklyn, of ample hills was mine. I too walked the streets of Manhattan Island and bathed in the waters around it. I, too, felt the curious, abrupt questioning stir within me. In the day, among crowds of people, sometimes they came upon me. In my walks home late at night, or as I lay in my bed, they came upon me. I, too, had been struck from the float, forever held in solution. I, too, had received identity by my body. That I was, I knew, was of my body. And what I should be, I knew, I should be of my body. I think that specifically the word queer is really appropriate for Whitman. And I think that the queer sensibility comes through in Whitman's questions. I don't think his poems have sure landing places. And I think that that's like the beauty of them, the sense that they don't ever decide upon one thing, that they're kind of in a constant attempt to find more questions. I think like a queer poetic sensibility, it can be applicable to definitely people who aren't queer in the sense that like allowing a self to be fluctuating and allowing a self to change. The reason why I love queerness is, well, one of the reasons is that idea of movement within one name. So you can have movement under like the queer umbrella. And I think everybody under themselves can and probably should have movement throughout their lives and throughout what they want to consider themselves.
That's Robin Gow. He's a poet, an LGBTQ activist pursuing an MFA in creative writing at Adelphi University.
Ralph Waldo Emerson proclaimed in his 1844 essay, The Poet, "We have yet had no genius in America, yet America is a poem in our eyes. Its ample geography dazzles the imagination, and it will not wait long for meters." Emerson was right. America did not wait long. Walt Whitman heard and responded to Emerson's call. Literary critic Harold Bloom believes that Walt Whitman remains unsurpassed in American letters today.
The few figures who could compete, the Herman Melville of Moby Dick, Nathaniel Hawthorne in The Scarlet Letter and elsewhere, Mark Twain, Emerson, Emily Dickinson, no single writer that we've had is anywhere near as powerful, original, influential, and deeply poignant and moving as Walt Whitman.
What I'd like to do is, if we can, is to put ourselves back in the moment when Whitman emerged.
Let us do that immediately. He goes home after years of journalism. He joins his father and his brothers. They're all carpenters. They build houses. He turns his back on the kind of dandy he had been and reinvents himself. And the early notebook fragments, which are tremendous, flower into the great poem, Song of Myself, which is still the greatest American work of art.
One of those fragments reads, "I am your voice. It was tied in you. In me it begins to talk. I celebrate myself to celebrate every man and woman alive. I loosen the tongue that was tied in them. It begins to talk out of my mouth. I celebrate myself to celebrate you. I say the same word for every man and woman alive. And I say that the soul is not greater than the body. And I say that the body is not greater than the soul."
Oh, that is astonishing. This is the only poet who could have written as he did in one of the 1856 poems called To You, Whoever You Are. He actually says it at one point, "I place my hand upon you that you may be my poem." I mean, Shakespeare is, of course, a greater poet, Dante, but they have nothing like that amazing immediacy in which the poet is actually putting his hand on you and saying, "Because I'm touching you, you may be my poem." There is something Christ-like about that. But then I think there is a kind of a deliberate attempt to be a kind of American Christ or Redeemer on Walt's part. He was brought up a Hicksite or radical Quaker, and he always remained one, sort of evangelical Quakerism, the original kind practiced by George Fox. But he really, as he said, wanted a new Bible for Americans, and amazingly, he tried to write it. Obviously, you can't do that, but he did as much as anybody could have done.
Bloom says that Song of Myself is suffused with Whitman's biblical sensibility. Most notably, in constructing the poem's central trope, Whitman borrowed from a verse in the first epistle of Peter, "For all flesh is as grass, and all the glory of man as the flower of grass. The grass withereth, and the flower thereof falleth away." Through Whitman, that verse famously became,
"A child said, what is the grass? Fetching it to me with four hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrance designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corner that we may see and remark and say, whose? Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoo, Congressman, Cuff. I give them the same, I receive them the same. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people and from women and from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are, the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. That's astonishing. In the entire history of literature, there's nothing that direct. He's really beyond praise.
When his book first came out, it was not universally admired. Is that right?
Oh, no, far from it. He said that he was writing for the average working man or woman, but he's actually a rather difficult poet. He invents a new metric, which is very delicate. He has rethought things for himself. You have to be a considerably educated person, even though he didn't want to hear that. He would not have wanted to have any elitist or university audience. He wanted people in the streets and on the farms.
And while it wasn't necessarily despised and rejected, Song of Myself was, in general, initially met with a kind of tepid indifference, except by one prominent author.
He sent a copy of it to Emerson, and Emerson, I think, the greatest critical act of any American writer, got this strange poem, reacted to it with a tremendous enthusiasm, and wrote a famous grand letter to Whitman saying, I greet you at the beginning of a great career. I think this is the finest piece of wit and wisdom which has come out of America, which was true. And then the two men met, and essentially Emerson is the father of Whitman. Though even though I'm a fierce Emersonian, I think Walt surpasses him.
And yet, according to Bloom, it is not through the written word that Walt Whitman reaches the height of his greatness.
The thing that I think makes him the greatest American beyond even, say, George Washington or Abraham Lincoln is what he did during the American Civil War. The hospitals were horrible. They were just unpainted shacks. And in it, there were, in Washington, D.C., thousands, untold thousands of soldiers, some Confederate, mostly Union, mostly white, but also black. Walt Whitman went there, and for years, from dawn until midnight, he served selflessly, beautifully, as an unpaid wound dresser and nurse. He did everything for these poor maimed and dying and frequently desperately illiterate people. He read books to them. He wrote letters home for them and read the letters. He did everything he could to buy little things that would make life better for them. You know, some fresh fruits or a little brandy or something. And hundreds of them died in his arms. It had a permanent effect on him. It broke his health. A stroke followed. And his great poetry really ends in 1865, though he lives on until the 1890s. So that really makes him a kind of ministering angel, almost the great secular saint of American civilization.
And even today, Walt Whitman, this American saint of vitality, angel of perpetual life, continues to sustain Harold Bloom and urge him onward.
I'm 89 years old. I still teach. I still write. My whole life long, I've been reading Whitman. I still don't feel I've reached a full understanding of him.
Harold Bloom is Sterling Professor of Humanities at Yale University. He's the author of many books, including The Anxiety of Influence, The Western Canon, and most recently, Possessed by Memory, The Inward Light of Criticism. As Harold Bloom just said, Whitman became a kind of visiting angel in Civil War field hospitals. But what initially prompted Whitman to leave New York during the Civil War? In 1862, Whitman received word that his brother, George, had been wounded at the Battle of Fredericksburg. Fearing the worst, he traveled down to the Virginia battle site. Much to Whitman's relief, he found that his brother had sustained only minor injuries. While he was there, Whitman was moved by an especially brutal scene.
He records a dramatic moment where he's standing in front of this field hospital and sees at the foot of two trees a pile of amputated limbs. He says, a full load for a one-horse cart. And these are limbs that had been thrown out the windows of the surgery in the haste of the battle and the emergencies.
That scholar and artist Robert Schultz. He says that this was the inciting incident that sparked Whitman's passion for tending the wounded.
And then he saw the men, and he traveled back by boat and rail to the Washington, D.C. hospitals and stays there for the duration of the war. He finds clerical work in the government, but spends his most valuable hours among the men in the hospitals.
How old was he at this time?
Well, let's see. He was in his mid-30s. He's in his middle age. And he really gave himself, even his health. I mean, it was a terrific strain. He talked to Horace Traubel, the man who documented almost everything Whitman said late in life when he was living back in Camden, New Jersey, in the years before he died. And he told Traubel about the way he ruined his health. He suffered a few strokes, pretty bad strokes at the end of the war. He really wore himself out. So he told Traubel, you know, I had to pay a lot for this experience, but it seemed cheap. And then he says, and what did I get? Well, I got the boys. For one thing, the boys. Thousands of them. They were, they are, they will be mine. I gave myself for them, myself. I got the boys. Then I got Leaves of Grass, the consummated book, the last confirming word. So he understood that his vocation during the war and the writing that he did completed and consummated this lifelong book, Leaves of Grass, that he started building in 1855.
So he dealt with Confederate soldiers as well. How would that have been?
Well, whoever was wounded and got scooped up was tended all the way back to D.C. and in the hospitals. They were not separated out.
And what was his sympathy toward them? Did he sort of hold them to account for rebellion against the United States, or did he approach them on a more personal level?
Well, that's really interesting because there are sorts of two levels here in which he deals with any individual. And certainly we know he was all for Union. He would certainly have condemned the rebellion, as he would have termed it.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have certainly judged the soldiers who fought on the wrong side. But then on another deeper level, the one that we see in Song of Myself and all through the career, there was a sense that every man is, every woman is an eternal soul in passage through this lifetime toward an eventual transcendental perfection. And in his wonderful post-war poem, Reconciliation, we see this gesture whereby he honors the enemy. He says, for my enemy is dead. A man divine as myself is dead. I look where he lies white-faced and still in the coffin. I draw near, bend down, and touch lightly with my lips the white face in the coffin. So at some ultimate level, he believed in every self as divine.
There's a sympathetic tone in Whitman that we also find in Abraham Lincoln. Maybe you could talk about the relationship that those two men had and what Lincoln meant for Whitman.
Well, he first saw him when Lincoln was traveling to D.C. after his election, and he only ever saw Lincoln from afar. They never met. There's some evidence that Leaves of Grass was seen by Lincoln in his Illinois law offices. Hmm. We don't know for sure.
Let's assume that it was. I just like that image too much.
Yeah, me too. But from the very beginning, from his first glance at this Westerner, this tall, bearded Westerner, Whitman idealized him. I mean, he always thought of the Western states and its dirty hands, its brawny shoulders, the men and women, a kind of American rough or pioneer, mm-hmm. and idealized them as the strength and sinews of the nation. And once Whitman had an apartment in D.C. during the war years, it turns out that his street was on the route that Lincoln took in from Soldier's Home when he spent the nights out there during the hot summers. And often Whitman would apparently stand in the street and see the president go by in his carriage, or sometimes simply on a horse with a few cavalry accompanying him. And he records various sightings and says that once he thinks that they met eyes and wonders if there had been a recognition.
You're involved in a very interesting effort of your own, an art project, War Memoranda. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, sure. It started quite a long time ago when I first saw some very interesting artwork by the photographer Bin Don, who works in the Bay Area. And his work was about the Vietnam War and the Cambodian genocide, but he took iconic photographs and the Khmer Rouge portraits of their captives and developed these images in the flesh of leaves through a chlorophyll action, that kind of sun prints. And I walked into the Art Museum of Western Virginia about 12 years ago and saw these things, and they just knocked my socks off. These genocide victims resurrected in leaves that grew out of the ground. And I thought, does this guy know Whitman?
Right.
This is amazing. I mean, this is the central trope of Whitman. Death goes into the ground and life comes back out of it. So I contacted him and I started writing poems in response to these beautiful artworks. And someone else must have fallen in love with this work, because Hollins University invited him to spend a semester here as a resident. And we started working together face to face, and he had not read Whitman, so I took care of that. And we started traveling up the East Coast, visiting the battlefield sites, and he's very much a landscape photographer too. And in these car trips, we started talking about Whitman, the Civil War, landscape, and art, and an art exhibition developed out of it. And recently, we've made a book encapsulating our art response to Whitman and the war. And it's called War Memoranda, Photography, Walt Whitman, and Memorials.
Well, you know, in recent years, people have criticized the Confederate memorials as a kind of false attempt at reconciliation, as a kind of shallow reconciliation over the lives of African-American people. So how would Whitman's ideas of reconciliation differ from those ideas of reconciliation we see in The Lost Cause?
I think he has delivered an uncannily direct rebuke to the white nationalists who marched in Charlottesville chanting the Nazi slogan, Blood and Soil, because for Whitman, American blood in American soil was not a tribal claim. And for him, the land entire, as he called it, was the most fitting memorial to the war dead. And he wrote in Memoranda During the War about the war dead, south or north, ours all, and said, the land entire is saturated, perfumed with their impalpable ashes, exhalation, in nature's chemistry distilled, and shall be so forever, in every future grain of wheat and ear of corn, and every flower that grows and every breath we draw.
So Whitman really is the poet of egalitarianism, of acceptance, of embrace rather than rejection. Do you think we'll be listening to him with new ears now?
I hope people get sent back to Whitman to read him, because, you know, the biggest thing I feel when I think of Whitman is, I mean, this picture comes into my mind of the aged Whitman, sort of barrel-chested, arms spread wide, because, you know, he made his discriminations, he made his judgments, but finally his embrace was wide and his vision was hopeful and humane, and we could use that right now.
Robert Schultz is the John P. Fishwick Professor of English at Roanoke College and the co-author of War Memoranda, Photography, Walt Whitman, and Memorials.
The Wound Dresser by Walt Whitman. On I go. Open doors of time, open hospital doors. The crushed head I dress. Poor crazed hand teared not the bandage away. The neck of the cavalryman with a bullet through and through I examine. Hard the breathing rattles. Quite gazed already the eye, yet life struggles hard. Come, sweet death, be persuaded, O beautiful death, in mercy, come quickly. From the stump of the arm, the amputated hand, I undo the clotted lint, remove the sloth, wash off the matter and blood. Back on his pillow, the soldier bends with curved neck and side, falling head. His eyes are closed, his face is pale, he dares not look on the bloody stump, and has not yet looked on it. I dress a wound in the side deep, deep, but a day or two more, foresee the frame all wasted and sinking in the yellow-blue cotton and sea. I dress the perforated shoulder, the foot with the bullet wound, clean, the one with a gnawing and putrid gangrene, so sickening, so offensive, while the attendant stands beside me holding the tray and pull. I am faithful. I do not give out. The fractured thigh, the knee, the wound in the abdomen, these and more I dress with impassioned hand, yet deep in my breast a fire, a burning flame. Now, that's not the Cosmos One of the Roughs. Right? You can see how tender those lines are. To me, there's two Whitmans. There's the bombastic, cosmic loudmouth, you know, who bounces around the world and declares all these things. And that's who he invents in the 1855 edition of Leaves of Grass. If you open the 1855 edition, you saw this character, right? That was this guy in the open, the shirt, you know, open, and the cocky hat tipped, right? You know, with his hands on his shoulder, like, what are you doing? What are you looking at? Yeah, I'm a poet. What do you think? Right? I mean, it's that kind of stance. And that, to him, is his idea of a persona, his idea of an American persona. One of the blurbs he writes for himself, he says that, you know, he recognizes no annihilation or death or loss of identity. You know, and that's that guy, right? Somebody who doesn't deal with death. Well, he sees at the hospitals the suffering and the amputations and the agonies that are going on. And that changes him into the second Walt Whitman, the Walt Whitman who isn't bombastic, who doesn't think he's better or bigger than death. He touches death, and death touches him, and it really changes the way he looks at the world from that point on. The abstractions are all gone. It's really straightforward. You know, he's unblinking. It's still lyric. It's still beautiful. You still hear the sort of declaration, almost sermonistic kind of, you know, tone to the lines, but they're quieter. so much quieter now, so much more attentive. And he's paying attention to something else other than himself.
That's Cornelius Eady. He's a poet, professor of English at SUNY Stony Brook, Southampton, and the editor of the Southampton Review.
Walt Whitman had high aspirations for his poetry. He hoped to bring disparate elements of the country together through the power of his written word. But how truly inclusive is the vision he articulates? I spoke to scholar Christina Beltran and started by asking her how Whitman understood the role of the individual in a democratic society.
So there's always this way in which he's trying to think about himself as part and parcel of a larger polity. And he's also always thinking about how he has inside himself the potential to be those other people. Whitman never uses the language of social construction, but he very much articulates that you are shaped by your environment. And you hear that in different works of his where, like in the poem, This Moment, Yearning and Thoughtful, where he says, you know, I can see them in Germany and Italy and China and Russia. And it seems I should become attached to them as I do men in my own lands. Mm. So he always is sort of pushing past national boundaries at times in his thinking and thinking about how we became who we are and how when you look at somebody who seems dramatically different than yourself, that in fact, maybe that would have been your story had circumstances been different, had you been born at that time or in that place or under those circumstances.
And it's one thing to think about bridging international divides or gaps kind of in the abstract, but Whitman is writing a lot of his work, obviously, on the doorstep of the Civil War, right? One of the most divided moments in the history of the country, just in the sense of the violence that is either threatened and, of course, then realized with the war itself. And, you know, I'm curious to get your sense of whether Whitman believed that his poetry could, in fact, unify the nation if it was on the brink of this conflict.
Yeah. No, there was a real sense in Whitman that he thought that the thing that might possibly save the nation is poetry, right? That perhaps, and that his own kind of adhesive voice could do this important work of reminding people of their shared humanity. There was a way in which he was trying to sort of create what I describe sometimes as a kind of poetics of equivalence, right? Which is that a lot of his poetry, you see him making these catalogs and these lists. I think of like the poem Starting from Pominock, where he says the Pennsylvanian, the Virginian, the double Carolinian, you know, and so he's placing Virginia, you know, next to Pennsylvania and trying to create this story of massive juxtaposition. And he does that by naming spaces of conflict, but placing them next to each other in this sort of poetic relationship. And I think hoping that maybe in that effort, we would see something in ourselves differently. If things are side by side, then perhaps we'll produce a kind of democratic affection for one another through his poetry. And when he writes about the Civil War, and he has poems like The Wound Dresser and some of those poems, you hear him describing in really, you know, intense detail, the suffering and sacrifice of soldiers and dead soldiers. But what he doesn't do is he doesn't talk about an enemy or a perpetrator, right? So you read these, for example, when you read his wartime poems, there's almost never a mention of the enemy. Instead, it's always this sort of story of heroism, sacrifice, the equally brave men who fought and died. And so he doesn't deny conflict, but he neutralizes it.
Now, walk us a little bit, you know, through what it must have been for Whitman as a white man in an economy of slavery, in an economy of disenfranchisement. But I'm curious, just given what you've laid out here, how we might understand what Whitman's politics were, specifically on the question of race.
He was an anti-extensionist. He opposed the extension of slavery into the Western territories. But he was more concerned about preventing the spread of slavery than really getting rid of it.
Right.
He denounced the pro-slavery Southern fire eaters, but he also called abolitionists red-hot fanatics. They were the angry-voiced, silly set, he described them. At the same time, right, so he took that kind of stance at the time, and he did not believe that African-Americans were capable of exercising the vote, right? Mm. So that's part of his story. At the same time, abolitionists and radical Republicans strongly identified with Whitman because of his celebrations of brotherhood and equality. And there is something really interesting about the way that he'll talk about the person with the venereally. He'll mention the thief. But there's also this way in which he often includes blackness alongside things that are kind of either degraded or
or
problematic. So in Song of Myself, he'll say, this is like one of the lines, he says, "The kept woman, sponger, thief are hereby invited. The heavy-lipped slave is invited. The venereally is invited." And so later on, he says, "Voices of the diseased and despairing of thieves and dwarves." In Song of the Open Road, he says, he sort of welcomes everyone, and he says, "The black with his woolly head, the felon, the diseased, the illiterate person are not denied." Right? So they're not denied, but it's interesting to think about where they're incorporated.
Right. And the way he's marking blackness, right? Heavy lips and woolly hair. I mean, this is... It's for that reason, I guess, I have to say that I'm really intrigued by the notion that you hear in Whitman a kind of a prologue to Barack Obama, who comes of political age after certainly the great cultural awakenings of Black Power and the civil rights struggle, and even like the 1990s. I mean, there's a lot that's happening culturally between Whitman's era and Obama's era, and yet you still hear something familiar.
I mean, Obama was always trying to engage our affections for the country by creating a poetic vision of national life. Even his own description of his own personal story was kind of, you know, having this Kenyan father and this white Kansas mother, kind of out of, you know, e pluribus unum, out of many one, right? Mm-hmm. He himself is the embodiment of that story, right? So he is continually kind of telling his own story that also engages in a certain kind of elision of difference. When he would lay things together in even his 2004 speech about, you know, we have some gay friends in red states and we worship an awesome God in blue states. You know, there was a kind of poetic way that he allowed us to see ourselves as one, right? But it also involved not saying a lot of things.
So you propose that the Chicana poet and scholar Gloria Anzaldúa offers an alternative to Whitman's democratic vision, and I suppose by extension, Obama's vision. How do you describe her mestiza poetics?
I think one of the things that she produces is another kind of form of democratic connectedness, but that challenges dangerous equivalences, because her characterization of borders is she characterizes them as borderlands are always home and not home. She doesn't have a dream of home as a space of origins and belonging. For Anzaldúa, home is always characterized by strangeness. It's always discontinuous and unstable. But it's not simply tragic. It's also generative of all these possibilities.
So, Christina, give me a sense of the language that Anzaldúa is using to capture this.
She has a poem called "To Live in the Borderlands Means You." It begins by her saying, "To live in the borderlands means knowing that the India in you, betrayed for 500 years, is no longer speaking to you. That Mexicanas call you rajetas. That denying the Anglo inside you is as bad as having denied the Indian or black. Cuando vives en la frontera, people walk through you. The wind steals your voice. You're a burra. Bui, scapegoat, forerunner of a new race, half and half, both woman and man, neither, a new gender." And then she goes on to say, "To live in the borderlands means to put chili in the borscht, to eat whole wheat tortillas, speak Tex-Mex with a Brooklyn accent, to be stopped by la migra at the border checkpoints." For her to be Chicana, to be a Mexican-American, is to be both Indian and Spanish, right? To be both settler and native, to be both the figure who's done violence and the figure that's been victimized by violence, and that you have to sort of sit with the fact that you are part and parcel of all of those stories. And I think that, so for me, there was a moment in Obama's political career when he gave that Philadelphia speech on race after the Reverend Wright scandal, where to me that was sort of the closest we ever saw Obama get to a kind of mestiza poetics, when he said things like, "I can no more deny Reverend Wright than I can deny my grandmother who loved me but was afraid of black men on the street." Right. And he sort of forced this encounter to say, we love people who are racist.
Right.
And so those were the moments where you thought, it's going to be a more grown-up encounter with the complexities of racial justice in this country, where there's not just good guys and bad guys, but we're actually dealing with the fact that the good guys are the bad guys. And the people who love you are also the people who've done enormous violence to you. And they're part of you.
And I get the impression that you're drawing a point to not just talk about him as a rhetorician or somebody who can kind of create this mass support, but that Obama actually governed in a Whitman-esque way, right? That he drew certain equivalences and that his political moves as a policymaker and as a leader, basically, in the political scene was also in some ways steeped in this vision of America.
Yeah. What struck me was that the strategies that proved productive for getting elected were so different than the strategies one needs for governing. I think we still fetishize this language of unity. The question I always have is, who's getting erased in this story? Whose interests are getting elided? Whose interests are getting pushed down? And often it's the same folks, right? It's queer people, it's people of color. It's poor people. It's usually similar populations. But there is a kind of dream of agreement that we have. And so I think candidates are always called on to emphasize that language. And one of the problems is that it is aesthetically and affectively, emotionally pleasing to hear the language of unity. But then the reality of governing is a space of contestation and agonism.
Well, this is, I think, you know, one of the biggest questions that every major political organization is trying to figure out, right, which is what's the right tone? What's the right rhetoric? I mean, there are a lot of ways in which people like to highlight the balkanization of American politics now as needing somebody like Whitman to kind of come in and dampen, you know, the divides. But, I mean, just to echo what you've said, I mean, it sounds at least that one of the challenges of having this kind of dampening language, that it doesn't, in fact, raise the alarms when there are deep inequalities that need to be considered.
And there's one thing I think that is also interesting here is that the adhesive quality of Whitman, that is the fact that so often he elides conflict, but he does show these connections. I do think that's actually democratically important in some contexts, right? Like, I do think that when you live in a city and you get on the subway and you look around you, you see all these different kinds of bodies on display before you. You see Orthodox Jewish families, you see migrant families, you see, you know, young people, old people, queer people, straight people, men and women. And in seeing that, in seeing all those different kinds of bodies on display, you feel this sense of like, this is us. I mean, I think as a New Yorker, you look around in different kind of urban spaces, DC or Chicago, you look at that and you say, this is who we are.
Right.
And you feel this sense of collectivity that's not unimportant, right? That when you go to your bodega and the guy is Lebanese or, you know, Korean, and that's a kind of daily encounter you have with different kinds of people, that those things do create a kind of sense of democratic solidarity that we are all in this together. But they are fleeting encounters, right? They're not sustained encounters, right? If that subway were to break down, we might all start hating each other pretty quickly. or if that subway, right, we all had to kind of become a polity together and try to make decisions, right? Then those differences could become problematic, that there's like a hedge fund manager in there and a homeless guy. Like, you know, all those people are sharing this public space. And that is, I think Whitman understood that those kinds of experiences of sharing the city, sharing city life, you know, being on the ferries, being on the bridges, that sharing civic life together is a beautiful and democratic and important element of how we come to feel each other as equally human. It's important, but it's deeply insufficient for the harder work of governing and the harder work of trying to create democratic community.
Christina Beltran is an associate professor in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis at NYU. She's the author of The Trouble with Unity: Latino Politics and the Creation of Identity.
When did you first become aware of Whitman? What did he mean to you when you did become aware of him?
Well, for me, it was in college, in the American Studies primer. And, you know, he was a figure placed very much alongside people like Henry David Thoreau and Mark Twain and Emily Dickinson and obviously Edgar Allan Poe as part of this 19th century world of letters that really did give shape to American studies for the 20th century. And so there was a way in which, you know, you encounter work like Leaves of Grass as, you know, almost being unimpeachable,
right,
in terms of its impact and it being a kind of holy text in some ways. And in particular, you know, I was among a number of students in the late 90s who were really thinking hard about questions of diversity and inclusion and environmentalism. And, you know, Walt Whitman could be absolutely one of your go-to heroes when you're coming to your education in that register. And there were a number of students who were themselves poets who really did gravitate toward and actually helped deepen my own appreciation of Whitman as, you know, an artist who, to their mind, really helped to launch basically, you know, gay poetic art and really recognized him as a gay artist. Again, whether or not that interpretation holds up over time is kind of beside the point, but I think it was really critical for a number of us to take a moment and say, you know, there are really important figures of, you know, normative sexuality who are part of forming our canon as we know it.
What I remember is my emotional reaction to reading Whitman. It for the first time, I understood that poetry wasn't a string of lines that were the same length that rhymed. I read Whitman and it touched me in some kind of a way. And I realized that poetry was a lot bigger. Right. It was a lot more embracing than I had understood it to be. So it really kind of fundamentally changed the way I thought about what you can do with poetry and the way you can communicate feelings in prose that way. But there was a second prong to my learning about Whitman, and that actually took place a couple of years later when I was working at the Library of Congress. And this is going to sound goofy, but I was an English major in college, so humor me. We were doing Civil War research, and I stumbled across some of Whitman's Civil War poetry. And I had this sort of strange aha moment, which essentially was, wait a minute, this poet is writing in the middle of a historical moment. And that's historical evidence, you know? And I know it sounds goofy, but some part of my brain was like, oh heavens, the connection between literature and history, which I just hadn't felt in that concrete a way before.
Well, you know, I was in New York not long ago and saw came in my room, was welcomed by a framed saying, which I was suspicious of its authenticity. It said, be curious, not judgmental. Walt Whitman. And I thought that sounded unpoetic to me. It also sounded a little convenient. So I did some deep research and looked for Walt Whitman sayings online. You can buy very many very attractive Walt Whitman sayings with sunsets and flowers and things on, going back to the environmental thing. Right. But that goes back to Nathan's point, is that he's seen as the great poet of not judging other people, of embracing everybody. But I don't know, that seems a little convenient for us, doesn't it?
Well, I think the fact that you found a quote on the wall in a hotel actually says a lot, right? which is that we furnish our lives with Walt Whitman, right? And people of his kind. And I do think there is something about, you know, the present day relationship with Whitman and, you know, his generation of poets that helps to give and kind of ground a sense of depth to an otherwise, you know, really, in some cases, light, you know, American existence. I mean, just think about American culture, right? If Whitman is part of this discussion of this great canon, I mean, he helped in a lot of ways to deepen otherwise, you know, possibly frivolous art forms. And I'm thinking specifically of a movie where Whitman's, you know, line that jumps out to me is, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," right? And I know that line because of the final
Dead Poet
scene,
Society.
Dead Poet Society, right? The whole point of that movie was to capture the depth and the power of poetry through this master teacher that Robin Williams is portraying. And what do they use, right? They use this Whitman moment as a way to really elevate the drama of the whole affair.
In part and otherwise, by standing on a desk to read it, right?
Absolutely.
Right. And I love the fact that all three of us have that moment, right? It's like in a nanosecond. We're
absolutely.
Like, Dead Poet Society.
Absolutely. And so Whitman's gravity, right, as a figure is evident in those kinds of moments. And you can almost add, you know, a Whitman quote to anything, put it on a, you know, a web page or put it on a hotel wall. And all of a
t-shirts.
Sudden, t-shirts, the depth factor goes up immeasurably. You know, so I think it's worth unpacking that a little bit. Yeah.
You know what that makes me think of, though? Because as soon as you started describing Whitman that way, the first person I thought of was Jefferson. Because
whoa, that's
his
weird.
Words
I'm sorry.
Have, no, but follow me. Come with me here. I'm going to take it home. I promise. In many ways, when I teach Jefferson, I teach him as the poet of the founding. He put into words what Americans want the founding to be, and we hang on to those words. And I'm not even just talking about the Declaration of Independence, but when we read about America through Jefferson, it's what we want America to be. And in some ways, you could say Whitman is kind of a poet of democracy. It represents what we want, in some ways, America to be.
So this is really helpful, actually, because, you know, as you know, we're talking and thinking and you know, just thinking about the 20th century and art, you know, my first impulse was to say, okay, do we have a 20th century poet who can really capture, you know, the national sentiment in the way that, say, a Walt Whitman could? Or to your point, you know, Joanne, which got me thinking along these lines, Jefferson, and the person that came to mind was, in fact, Martin Luther King Jr., right? As somebody who, just from the rhetorical stance, whose words are etched into granite, right? Who are the kinds of wordsmiths who get their words etched into granite in national memorials or, you know, on the walls of buildings, right? And there's something about the coming together, the bridging, the universal themes that someone like Walt Whitman helped to consecrate. Obviously, Jefferson, to your point, as being the great founder of this kind of language, and King, you know, has so many of these quotes, in some cases ripped out of context, to do exactly that kind of work, that it feels in a weird way that Whitman's kind of a halfway point between these two figures who, in some ways, define these different epochs of American history.
That's really great. And we think about Whitman's kind of twin in his own period is Abraham Lincoln, who I think is the other person who tries to find what's redeemable in this country, even in the face of the unredeemable, you know? I mean,
that's a really distinctive language, too.
Exactly. And, you know, we recognize their language enough, perhaps, to put it on posters in hotel rooms that sounds like an authentic voice. So Lincoln is taking the King James Version of the Bible, and so does King, and turning it into an American idiom. What's interesting about Whitman, and that extent about Jefferson as well, they're speaking in a non-Christian way. You know, it's funny that you might think of as sort of great, and frankly, Lincoln as well does not really speak in an explicitly Christian language as well. And it's funny when we think about this canon that you were talking about, Nathan, that we celebrate people who don't embody sort of the cultural traditions of the majority population. Somehow that they take a distillation of what's best about the United States and give it back to us in a new language.
And a language that it's a, I don't want to say limited, but a channeled language, right? It includes a very specific vision, and there's a lot of stuff happening outside of that vision, but the purity of the language kind of holds you there in the center.
Absolutely. You know, Whitman is speaking at a time when obviously a lot of the country is having its citizenship and its democratic rights being taken away at the end of Reconstruction, right? The 1880s are a really tough period in America for a lot of people. Obviously, westward expansion is another one of these extraordinary processes that are, you know, growing the country in some ways, but deeply anti-democratic in other ways. And I guess, you know, when we think about the long history of these great voices, one of the things that is so common through them is that they're oftentimes speaking over or trying to capture these moments of great contestation and doing it in a way that has you feeling in some ways connected again, right? There's a way that they're trying to cross certain fissures or chasms and bring people together when the news cycle may be telling us to do otherwise.
Just as you're saying, in that sense, by doing that, they're providing a tool that people can use that language to demand their rights, to get through those moments, to institute change.
Yeah, one thing about these voices is that, you know, Whitman has been criticized for not really having a sense of sin or evil in his poetry. And yet, it's hard to think of anybody who embraced suffering more than he did, choosing to go among all those shattered young men in the hospitals of Washington day after day, year after year. He knows about evil. He knows about sin. He knows about loss. And yet, as both of you were saying, he speaks a bridging language to get us to the other side of that. You know, he holds up an aspiration that would be America at its best.
That's going to do it for us today, but you can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of the episode or ask us your questions about history. You'll find us at backstoryradio.org or send an email to backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger. Special thanks this week to the Johns Hopkins Studios in Baltimore.
Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Executive Vice President and Provost at the University of Virginia, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.